The unruffled beat of Ray Lynch's Clouds Below Your Knees signals 8 p.m. Wednesday and time for So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling. And it's right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. I'm your host, Dr. Mary Edgerton, along with an ensemble of gifted hosts. Dr. Hank Rubicek, our show's founder. Greg Audell, appearing with Floyd the Wonder Dog. And since we're on radio and you can't see, I want to tell you he's had a recent haircut. And Dr. Warren Holloman, our master of wellness. Rounding out our team are our chief production engineer and media director, Nicole Rocherlin, and our intern, Tatiana Gago. So I'm going to jump right into this. My family has suffered from depression across multiple generations and still does. I myself have worked to deal with this monster. I wanted to make people more aware of the impact of depression on our lives through storytelling, and not just the impact of depression, perhaps the impact of how we find our way out of the depression also. Tonight's program isn't about a medical description of the types of depression or the ways in which it debilitates one's life or the treatment symptoms and the like. Yes, that is certainly critical, and it is our collective responsibility to learn about depression so that we can act as soon as it rears its ugly head. But this is a program about storytelling, and tonight, with a little help from familiar friends, we'll look at the fierce impact of depression through a storyteller's lens. I hope that you as listeners will appreciate the stories and that they will bring us together as members of a world family. As my guests, I have Dr. Michael Winters, a psychologist in private practice here in Houston. Michael's a terrific teller. He's told stories, he's won at the Moth Story Slam several times, and he uses storytelling as an integral part of his practice. He's been a guest on So What's Your Story a few times. He's on the board of the Houston Storytellers Guild, and he's a dear friend and supporter of our program. Our other guest, actually we have several guests, but another of our guests is Dr. Warren Holloman. He's a master of wellness. However, it is his passion for storytelling and willingness to tell his own personal stories that make him an essential contributor to this topic. And finally, Dr. Hank Rubicek, the creator of this program, who is a communications professor, but like Warren, it is his love of story that places him in a position to tell his own stories relevant to tonight's program. So, everybody, welcome. Michael, let's start with you.
Okay.
In the book, The Healing Art of Storytelling, its author, Richard Stone, refers to the term de-storification, a growing absence of storytelling in our society. So why is there a reluctance for people to tell stories about their lives?
I think there's several reasons that are going on. One is there's a shame that goes on in terms of people just don't feel like they have something worthwhile saying. So that's one thing. They don't have something worthwhile, or second, they're afraid of that vulnerability that their own story tells. So those are the things that I think are, you know, for many people, blocking them from telling their own story.
Almost a self-esteem of where you fit into
life. Yeah, absolutely. Especially our theme tonight, depression. People, when they have that self-esteem problem, then they feel even more reluctant to tell their story, when in fact telling their story, being heard, is one of the most powerful things they can do.
So I know you use storytelling in your practice. How do you encourage clients to tell their stories?
Well, being a good listener is the main thing. Letting them have a safe place to talk, and letting them have an opportunity to tell the story, and being interested in the story, and moving beyond. A lot of times people will give the superficial kind of sanitized story, and letting them know that I'm okay with that, but I'm really interested in the deeper stuff, what's really going on.
And what do these stories tell you when you have a new patient in your office?
You know, I mean, there's so much that we do is clinical, but the story is where the personal, where it moves beyond a category and it really moves into this person's unique life situation. Every person's life is unique, and the way people suffer is unique, and letting them have that opportunity to tell their story is really, you know, just a very profound piece of the work.
Well, we're going to come back to you in just a little bit, and you told me that you have some short stories that you use as the psychologist in therapy, yeah. And we'll hear some of those. But now we're going to turn to Warren. Warren, your story illustrates what stories about depression can do to help the depression-laced teller. So this is a story that you told at the Moths Grand Slam just a few weeks ago. Now, before telling us your story, tell us when you first gave yourself permission to tell this story in public.
Well, the short answer to that would be about 22 years after it happened. And I guess I mean that really seriously. I can't imagine even understanding my own story for the first 20 years or so. It took a while to get some perspective on it. But second, it was an ongoing illness, and I wasn't ready to talk publicly about it until I felt that I was safe, and it was mostly in the past.
That's very meaningful. And the idea of an ongoing story inspires me to just make this comment. Health insurance companies don't like to pay for mental health care, and they say nobody gets cured. But you know what? Nobody gets cured of type 1 diabetes. You take insulin for life. Nobody gets cured of hypertension. You take your blood pressure medicines for life. And I resent the fact that the insurance companies have this different framework in which they measure mental health care. But Let's get back to you.
Yeah. So I think what I was also trying to say was that when the experience is fresh and raw and it's something as dangerous as depression, I guess, my energy needs to be focused on healing and not on sort of entertaining people with my story.
So tell us your story.
Okay. So now, well, first of all, this is a story about depression, but it's also a love story. It's an attempt to mix the two together. So, don't you just love that balcony scene in Romeo and Juliet? Well, my love story has a balcony scene also. And while I realize that our names, Warren and Marcia, don't sound quite as poetic as Romeo and Juliet, we do share a lot in common with that iconic couple. Number one, we fell in love as teenagers. Number two, we married shortly thereafter. Number three, we had every intention of living happily ever after. And then, like Romeo and Juliet, number four, something bad happened. In our case, what happened was me. I developed a mental illness, specifically depression. And when you're depressed, it's really hard to live happily ever after. In fact, the primary symptom of depression is that you're profoundly unhappy. Sometimes that expresses itself as sadness, sometimes as irritability or anger, sometimes as aloneness or loneliness or isolation or alienation. And then sometimes you don't feel anything. You just feel empty. But the bottom line is you're profoundly unhappy. And it's not just like, it's so hard to explain to somebody who hasn't experienced it, but it's not like you're just having a bad day. It's like every day is bad. And it's not just that some bad situation occurred. You feel that way even when things are going well, because it's really rooted in a chemical imbalance in your brain. And that's why you can't just will yourself to get better. And believe me, I tried and tried and tried. In addition to affecting the way you feel, the depression also affects the way you think. It fills your head with all kinds of irrational thoughts. And in my case, there were two irrational thoughts that had a huge impact on my love story. I'd like to tell you about those two thoughts. The first was the thought that things would just be better for everybody if I was just dead. And that, unfortunately, is where the balcony scene comes into my story. We were on a family vacation in Colorado. My wife had gone mountain biking. I stayed back to cook dinner while the children took a nap. Those thoughts of suicide came to me, as they did most days, but this day was different because on this day, we were in a high-rise condo, and there was a balcony. And I found myself throughout the course of that afternoon out on that balcony, just staring at the ground. And in time, I selected the spot where I wanted to land. And for some strange reason, I wanted to land as far from the building as possible. I don't really know why, except just the idea that I didn't want to just fall passively to my death. I wanted to fly head first. I knew that to do that, I would need a running start. I went back into the living room. I was trying to conjure up the courage when, of all things, the timer on the oven went off. So instead of running off the balcony, I ran into the kitchen to turn off the alarm. I'm not sure why. I guess I didn't want to wake the children. But also, I think it just didn't feel right to kill myself when an alarm was going off. I know that sounds crazy, but when you're depressed, you're crazy. The other irrational thought was that I was married to the most wonderful woman in the world, but I convinced myself that my depression had been caused by the fact that I had married too young. And if I could just be a teenager just one more time, I could cure my mental illness. So, like a teenager, I started having these crushes. They were silly, stupid, but kind of sweet, teenage-type crushes, and I had those on many of the women in my life. But the one I had the biggest crush on was a beautiful young doctor, and we'll call her Carol. Together, Carol and I ran a small community health center in downtown Houston, and I think we made a great team. She took care of the medical problems as a doctor. I took care of the mental health problems. Now, I know what you're thinking. That's a little bit ironic. But just so you'll understand the situation, I don't think Carol understood the irony. I think the one thing I did well during that time, and I think a lot of depressed people do this well, is I hid my mental health problems while I was at work. At any rate, Carol and I were usually the first to arrive at the clinic in the morning, and I so enjoyed those times together. We would have quiet conversations before the chaos of the clinic workday began, and I think she looked forward to seeing me too. She would tell me things she didn't tell other people. Early one morning we were talking, and she was kind of agitated that morning, I remember. She had something on her mind, and she got up and shut the door. She took me by the arm, and at least in my imagination, she pulled me close, and she said, "I need to talk about something with you, something personal." Now, my heart was racing. She hadn't yet put on her white coat. I remember she was wearing the prettiest dress, and I remember those beautiful gray eyes. And I was focused on that dress and those eyes, so I was not prepared for what came next. Here's what she said. Out of the blue, she said this. "Today is my sister's birthday, but nobody in my family has even mentioned it. In fact, we haven't celebrated her birthday for 10 years. Since I can't talk with my family about it, I'm telling you. Do you know why we don't celebrate my sister's birthday? It's because on this day, 10 years ago, my father committed suicide." Then she grabbed me by both arms and started shaking me. And she was sort of halfway between screaming and crying and saying, "How could he be so selfish?" Carol's words hit me like a brick. First of all, I didn't realize the pain and the tragedy that she was living with in her own family and in her own experience, just as I don't think she realized what I was going through or what her words might mean to me. Second, I had no idea that a suicide could cause a family so much hurt. All along, I'd been thinking that if I ended my life, I'd be doing my family a favor. They could stop worrying about me, and they could get on with their lives. I was wrong. Third, I had no idea that a suicide could engender so much anger and resentment. Again, I had this irrational thought that once it was all over, my wife and children would realize the suffering I'd been through, and they would feel sorry for me. Carol felt sorry for her sister, but she was still pissed at her father, even 10 years later. In that moment, I had an epiphany. I realized I wasn't in love. I was effed up, just like her father had been effed up. And if I didn't get professional help soon, I'd be just like her father. I'd be dead. And I wouldn't even get the consolation prize of my family feeling sorry for me. Even 10 years from now, they'd still be angry. Well, I was lucky. I got some very good professional help. In fact, by the way, one of the people who helped me was the partner of Michael Winters, who's sitting right there. His name is Dr. Sam Buser. As a result, not only am I still alive, I'm still married to Marcia, the girl I had the teenage crush on when we were still actually teenagers. And the miracle is Marcia and I are back to living happily ever after. In fact, on June 18th, we're going to celebrate our 40th wedding anniversary. And that is a miracle. And to do it, in case you're wondering, we're going back to Colorado. We're staying in a condo. And yes, it has a balcony with this beautiful view. But don't worry about me. I'm not stupid. This time, we're staying on the second floor.
That's a wonderful story. And I have to say, when I hear that story, and I know you and Marcia, there was a disconnect between this, you and Marcia being so much in love and such a wonderful couple, and this embroilment you went through, but to realize that it wasn't Marcia and it wasn't your marriage, it was your depression, and you were trying to find an excuse for it.
Yeah, thank you.
So, Michael, what's your impression here?
I'm so glad that you persisted and that you recognized that there was help that was available, and that even as bad as it was, you could find a way through it. I think that's the thing that so many people don't believe, that there's a way through it. One of the things that I often tell is the white horse story. And that's very simple. There was a farmer that had this white horse, and it was a beautiful animal. And all the villagers came and said, "Oh, you must be so proud of your beautiful white horse." And the farmer's response was, "We'll see." So one day, there was a big storm, and the white horse ran away. So all the villagers came to the farmer and said, "Oh, you must be so sad. Your beautiful white horse is gone." And the farmer said, "We'll see." So this horse was apparently not only popular among people, but horses too, because about 3 weeks later, the horse came back, but there were 7 wild Mustangs following him, and they all walked right into the farmer's corral. And all the villagers said, "You must be so happy. You have all these new horses." And the farmer's response, of course, was, "We'll see." So not long after that, his son was riding the horse, and the horse got spooked and reared up, and the son fell off and broke his arm, really crushed his arm, and it was very badly mangled. And all the villagers were very concerned and said, "Oh, you must be so distressed because your son's arm is so hurt. He won't be able to do any work." And he said, "We'll see." About a week later, the king sent out his army to find new conscripts. So they came to the village, and every able-bodied young man, which was every young man in the village except for the farmer's son, was taken away, and all the villagers said, "You must be so happy that your son was spared." And the farmer, of course, said, we'll see. When you're in depression, you can't really imagine a future that will be different than what you have right now. So I'll tell that story to help people see. You can't see it right now. And often I'll tell them, you know, I'm going to hold on to the hope for you. I'm a hope peddler. That's really what I do. It's not clinical, but that's what I do, is I hold on to the hope while people aren't able to access it. And hopefully, if I have enough of a relationship, they start to trust me, and they see they can tell their story, and that I can hold that hope for them.
I love that term, hope peddler. Mm-hmm. I'm going to remember that. So, Hank, what are your thoughts here?
Well, I love that term too, hope peddler, and I love that story that Michael just told. I've heard that before, and it's very meaningful. And, you know, I've heard Warren's story before too. And, you know, one of the beautiful things about these stories is that they're the kind of story that you want to hear over again. For the same reason, interestingly, that you're experiencing depression, because for me, depression was being in a hole, trying desperately to get out. And you have to keep trying to get out, but you can't. You can't get out. I don't know if that makes sense. And when I heard Warren's story, that's what it reminded me of. It reminded me of being in that hole, trying desperately to get out, and you can't. You just can't find a way to exit. You can't grasp the side. You can't get a foothold. And we need to hear stories like that. It was a beautiful story. It was about as authentic as a story can possibly be.
Well, Hank, I'm going to stay here with you. You have many stories about your son and about being a long-distance father. And I know depression spurred those stories, and that you kept journals that inspire the stories that you've told us and told at the Moth.
Yes.
So you have a story that centers around your journals. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. You know, I start, Mary, all these stories really the same way, for no other reason than it reminds me of what inspired them all. I came home one day and, you know, my son was gone, and his mother had taken him into Florida. She hated living here. She orchestrated it with her father, and ironically, her father eventually disowned his entire family. He was not a really good person, and he eventually disowned everybody, which is an entirely different story, but I think you get the idea. I was a person who wasn't seen as successful. I wasn't seen as worthy, and I needed help. Friends, you know, became distant suddenly, and couples that we knew do what couples do. They defriend us for fear of being viewed as taking sides. And I also had to overcome an emotional assault, albeit unintentional, by my grandparents and my mother, and at the time very despondent biological father, who believed that depression was an excuse. Depression, I would be told, because I was depressed all of my life. Depressed, you know, try being in a concentration camp, my grandmother would bark. That's depression. Now, smile, laugh, get some sleep. Go have something to eat. And I knew that was ridiculous. But, you know, what are you going to do when you're 8, 9 years old? And I lived with that. And I know that you told me that you, too, lived with that to an extent. And I resented that. And this all leads to the journals, because that kind of resentment is really what spurred the journal writing to begin with. But to such an extent that I actually had, I'm not going to call it a confrontation, but a very honest discussion with my mother in 1992 about how I felt all of those years, about how I didn't feel supported, how I didn't feel understood. I wasn't allowed to be who I was and to feel the way that I felt. In any event, this episode with my son, as you might imagine, put me in extreme despair to the degree where my heart literally did fall to my gut, and it stayed there. I couldn't feel it in my chest. It was a physiological disorder that I never dreamed would be possible in a person's body. Lee Winderman, who I know Warren knows, Dr. Lee Winderman, saved my life. He really did. He was a magnificent therapist, and he treated me in every wonderful sense of the word. I went to him twice a week for 3.5 years, and then once a week for another 5 years. I wanted to keep coming back. He said, you don't really need me much anymore because you're keeping all these journals. I said, I'm afraid. He said, I know you are. Write about that and come back to me in 2 years. And that's what I did. So the long and the short of it is that I went to him for about 10.5 years in total. He encouraged me to keep a journal. He said, I know you like writing and thinking and you love stories. Why don't you write a journal? And I said, I'm not much into diaries. He says, it's not a diary. It's your friend. It's something that is raw and real and something that you never have to monitor and something you never have to correct. You don't ever worry about spelling. Write upside down if you want. Write in red if you're feeling lousy. Write in green if you're feeling positive. But just make sure that you sign every entry because you want to make sure that you can see your signature and make sure that you time it. Because when you write at 2 a.m., it's going to be significantly different than 2 p.m. So I did all of that. And that was important. And I did that along with something that I'm probably more proud of than anything in my life, although I would never have done it any other way. I went to Florida every month, and I do mean every month, for 17 years. I kept all of the receipts from the airlines just to kind of prove it to myself and hold on to that every month. And I would write every day before going to see my son. I used to write questions. I used to write plans. For example, I learned how to communicate with my son. He wasn't even 3 years old when he was taken away. And I had to learn how to speak to him over the phone because I wasn't going to ask questions like, how's school? When you're 5 or 6, you're going to say, fine, and get off the phone. I needed to elongate that. And I learned to ask him questions like, Josh, I know that you're talking about the heart at school this week, and I want to know how you take someone else's pulse, which required that I had to call the school every Monday morning to find out what the curriculum was, and I did. And I would ask him school-related questions that required an open response, and all of that made me feel really good. Well, I don't want to have to get too mired in that, but the journaling helped me tremendously. And one day, after doing several workshops for fathers, and also mothers, but mostly fathers, around town on how to deal with the long-distance parenting. That was the workshop that I did several times. I got a call from a woman by the name of Kathleen Adams, the author of this book. Now, Kathleen, I never heard of her before, and she said, hi, I'm Kathleen Adams. I'm an author. I run a place called the Center for Journal Therapy in Boulder, Colorado. I said, wow. And I've heard about you. I said, you have? She said, yes, I know that you're doing several workshops because some people, two men at least, who I know, were in your workshops in Houston. And they told me they were really impressed. And I want to look for men who keep journals because I'm writing this book entitled Mightier Than the Sword that's dedicated to fathers. And I'd like to look at a couple of your entries. And I said, well, my entries aren't for publication, but she flattered me, you know. And she said, please, go ahead and fax them in. Faxing was big in those days. Okay. So I faxed in a couple of entries that I felt to be safe. Within 30 minutes, she calls me back, and she was in tears, and she said, I need these and others that you can spare. I want to showcase you in the chapter entitled Fatherhood. Now, there's no royalties or anything, but when the book signing takes place, I want you and the other contributors to come to Boulder at a Borders bookstore where they had the signing and join us. Will you do that? And I said, sure. So about eight and a half months later, the book was in print and she invited me to Boulder. And I went to Borders bookstore and I had a latte and I'm in the stacks and I didn't want to be seen. I wanted to be undiscovered. And then there was a man about my age at the time who got up and read me. Hmm. He read a couple of my entries. And, you know, when I think about it, I think about what happened then. I was in tears and I couldn't believe that he had captured me so effortlessly. When he was done, I made sure that the crowd sort of left, and I walked up and I introduced myself, and he was embarrassed. And, "My God, I wish you were here. I wish." I said, "No, no, 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 no." And I hugged him and I said, "You have no idea what kind of a gift you gave me. No idea." And I remember that because it was a time when I felt that I mattered, and it was a moment in my life where I felt I was doing something right. I didn't know what it was, but I felt that I was doing something right. So journaling is really the pinnacle of my parental success, and in many ways, without the journal, this is not a stretch. I don't know if I'd be here with any, if I would be here, I don't know if I'd be with any level of sanity.
Hank, that's a beautiful story. We've actually heard two very beautiful stories, and I want to talk about them some more. But it is time for, and I used to love this term as a kid, station identification. So, I am Mary Edgerton, and you are listening to So What's Your Story with Drs. Michael Winters, Warren Holloman, and Hank Rubicek on KPFT 90.1 Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 in Huntsville. And having heard these stories, I think that this is a great time to mention two very important telephone numbers for people who are suffering from depression or who just reach a crisis. So here in Houston, we have the crisis hotline. Please get your pen, get your paper, get ready.
And Nicole will put this on our website, too,
which is a good idea. Thank you.
Thank you. On our Facebook page.
Facebook page.
Right. It's 713-468-5463. There is also a National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. That's an 800 number, 800-273-8255. Okay, to the guys in the back room, Tatiana's not here, but Greg Audell is back there with Nicole Rochelin. So actually, you have all four hosts here.
Are you allowing non-doctors on the program tonight? We're feeling very intimidated in here. Nicole and I employed, although Nicole is about to be a college graduate.
That's right.
In 4 days.
And that brings me to an announcement. Before we begin the announcements about storytelling events in the Houston area, I want to announce a very happy ending to one story coming up in a few days. A very big congratulations to our very own Nicole Rochelin, who is graduating with a BA in Communication Studies, Concentration in Corporate, this Saturday at Minute Park.
And I bet she's going to do it in style, if I know Nicole.
Without a doubt. So, Nicole, you ready for that?
I am so ready. It almost seems unreal to me because the journey just through it all, the journey, the depression, the everything coming out of, and still, I'm still standing. I'm still here, and I reached my goal, so I'm into planning what's next for me.
I don't know how you can possibly beat your career here at KPFT, but we wish you the very best.
So it's not just Houston strong, it's Nicole Rochelin strong.
Yes, amen.
I love it.
We are so proud of you, Nicole, and
thank
I think
you.
We all know this program is better for your participation. And the audience doesn't always see all the things you do, but you know, you help make this a stronger show and you help make us better hosts.
Thank you so much.
So, as you end that chapter and you begin new stories in your life, tell us about storytelling in Houston.
Well, besides this amazing opportunity here every Wednesday for listeners to listen in, Houston is a storytelling central, and that is for sure. To develop telling skills, listeners will want to join our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, and they meet the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel, and that's located at 1500 Sunset. And be sure to visit the Guild's website at www.houstonstorytellers.org for upcoming events and all of our past So What's Your Story programs, every show since 2008. It's listed right there for you on the menu under the radio tab. And also our friend at The Moth hold their story slams the second Tuesday of the month at Warehouse Live. And next month, the theme is endings. So story lovers may want to begin their storytelling venture with an ending in mind. What else, Greg?
Well, first and foremost, I want to say that this is an outstanding show tonight. The stories have all moved me to tears, but it's so important because if you are going through depression yourself or a loved one is going through it and you so desperately want to believe they're going to get better, you need to know they're not without action. You know, and I think talking about it tonight is so important, and let people know talking about is the most important thing you can do toward finding answers. So that is my thought on that. But we also want everyone to know that not having a radio is no excuse for missing our program, because you can listen to us stream live on kpfd.org and on Facebook Live. Tell us what you think about our shows or suggest program ideas by visiting our So What's Your Story Facebook page, and we promise we will get back to you. And please be sure to share our program with your friends. And if you love it, we'd love it if you would like us when you leave, because our Facebook page is growing every single day, and it's because of you and your friends who keep talking about it.
Thank you so much, Greg. And to all of you out there, don't forget we are on YouTube. It's So What's Your Story. So we're all over the place. Isn't that right, Mary?
Oh, we definitely are all over the place, and we have listeners all over the world, and whoever wants to listen to us in the space station actually can, and actually watch the Facebook page. Well, thank you both for that comprehensive update. So let's revisit the notion of journaling as an avenue for storytelling. So, Hank, can you read us an entry from your journal? Just give us an idea of what that's like.
Yeah. I know that we're spending some time here, so I'm just going to read one. And this is just at random. This one was written in November of 1993. At some point, I said I love you as much as a super big ice cream cone that fills the whole sky. And Josh laughed, but soon fell back to his little resigned sadness. And I couldn't believe that he was sad. This is the sadness of children and divorce. That's what it looked like, at least, and it must be lived and felt. I felt it, too. I felt it every moment of every day. To feel things together is at least better than feeling them alone, I thought. But that night, he laughed that wonderful, abandoned laugh of pure joy, suddenly. And then he leaned over and whispered into my ear. He told me it was a secret. I said I couldn't hear him. He whispered again, but I still didn't hear. "Say it to me louder," I said. And Josh whispered just audibly, "I want you to come live with me." That's what he said, and I didn't know what to say. I never do. That's just one.
You have brought tears to my eyes with that. That was very beautiful. Guys, I'm going to tell y'all a story as a closer, but before I do, I just want to go around the table here and just let you give each of you an opportunity to say, what did you want our listeners in Radio Land to learn from your story? So I'm going to start with you, Warren.
Well, this is not a comment about storytelling, more about mental health, but something that you've and Michael have also said is this, just that if you're suffering from these symptoms, just be humble about them and don't do what I did and think for years that you could just sort of will yourself to health. There are mental health professionals who can help you, and that's a big part of what it takes.
That is so very important to know.
And I'd say as far as the storytelling aspect of what's going on tonight, I'd say that that if you are fortunate like me and you reach a point when this scary thing is in the past, then it opens up a whole new chapter of now discussing it with your family. And so this happened 20 to 25 years ago, and now we're just beginning to have a really clear conversation about that, because it had a what I went through had a profound impact on my family, and so now I need to sort of discuss that and try to we need to work through that as a family. It takes a long time to do these things.
Yes, yes, but I, like I say, I know you and Marcia, and I know you have a very, very strong family and a very strong love for each other. And but you're absolutely right. This is not something where you can say, I'll just wait, tomorrow it'll get better. I mean, I know that I'm getting depressed when I have this feeling, I get it at work, where I just want to crawl under my desk and hide under there in a little fetal position and make the world go away. And that's when I know I need to think about what's going on here. So, Hank.
I think, you know, strength, it's all about strength in many ways. I've learned what I think I want people to know, and I hope this makes sense, is that when you're feeling hurt, when you're feeling bad, you've got to feel it and feel it and feel it, allow yourself to feel it till it comes out the other side. You have to get rid of it, right? You have to get rid of it. You can't let it hover. You have to get rid of it. Journaling helped me do that, and therapy, of course, but you have to get rid of it because it's okay to feel it, and it's going to feel terrible.
But it's
true. You've got to feel terrible in order to feel good.
It's okay to feel it. So, Michael.
Yeah. The image that comes up for me when we're talking about storytelling and depression is imagine a suspension bridge, and it's covered in fog. So you can't see the other side. So you have to go a little bit on faith, on hope that there's something out there. But if you take one step and then you take another step, eventually you get to the middle of the bridge and you can't see the starting place either, but the only way to get to the other side, which there is another side because the suspension bridge doesn't just end, but you have to have that hope and that faith that you can make it, but you have to just take one step at a time, and eventually there is another side. And believing that when you don't see it, that's the challenge.
So I always remind myself when I have that feeling of going under the table that I don't know how long this is going to last. Mm-hmm. I know the avenues I can reach out to. Mm-hmm. But I have felt like going under the table before, and I have gotten back out from under the table. So I know I can do it again.
Yep.
So I'm going to tell y'all a story of an experience of mine. I discovered my husband had been cheating on me for about 5 years, and I was devastated. My ego was devastated. My self-esteem was devastated. I was depressed. I couldn't sleep at night. I didn't know whether I should divorce him or not. And he wanted to stay together. I had young children. And I didn't even know what to think next. Not to mention that this was right about the time that two planes flew into the Twin Towers. And I felt like everything in my life was crumbling around me. So I started in therapy with him. I have to say, somehow I was able to separate my work life from my emotional life. I continued to go to work every day. I went to therapy as an outpatient. I wasn't hospitalized. I'm a pathologist. I was able to sign out my cases. And if I felt I was having a bad day, I would go sit down with somebody and say, look at this. I think this is what this is. What do you think? You know, and we do that all the time. So there's nothing unusual about that. So about 4 years later, we moved to Florida, and I was applying for a Florida medical license, and I kind of thought nothing of it. I'm a real type A person. I graduated second in my medical school class, even though I was older and I had two children at home. And I passed the boards, and I studied breast pathology with one of the finest breast pathologists in the world. And importantly, I had never had a lawsuit against me. And so I applied for this license, and there was this question that said, have you ever been diagnosed with an Axis I disorder? And depression is an Axis I disorder. And I thought, well, I could say no, because that was a few years ago, and it didn't really affect my work life. But then I wouldn't be telling the truth. And one thing about type A personalities is you're also very type A about having the truth. So I checked, yes, I had suffered from an access 1 disorder. And I finally got all my paperwork in, things from a database they keep of physicians who've been lost their licenses in one state or another or had malpractice charges. I get everything in. Took a while. And I call them up and say, so will I get my license next week? And they said, oh, no. We have put you off to the side because you checked that question. We have to investigate that. And we have to determine whether you need to join the Impaired Physicians Network. I said, the Impaired Physicians Network? They said, yes, we'll send you some mail about it. I started getting these pamphlets about the Impaired Physician Network. So it turns out that in Florida, the vast majority of physicians in the Impaired Physician Network are people with drug addiction problems, which I didn't have. I did have to go for a drug test. I continued to get all this mail about we can help you with your addiction problems. And I would like to know what rehab center calls itself the Impaired Addicts Network. You know, this was just insulting. And I cried, and I would send more information in, and my case would get put off. And 4, 5, 6 months went by, and I finally got myself together and said, I don't need Florida. I don't need them to approve of me. I know who I am. And I went to the head of the hospital, the CEO, and I said, I sent him an email. I really enjoyed working here. But if I don't get my license within 2 months, I'm going to leave because I'm a pathologist. I practice. Oh, he said, okay. So he gets in touch with the dean of the medical school that we were associated with. And that dean calls me and says, so it just so happens that I'm going to have the physician who's in charge of the Impaired Physician Network on the phone on a conference call today, and I'll just hold him on for a few minutes longer and ask him to look at your case. I had my license in 2 weeks. I went and I looked at the medical board to see who had been reprimanded by the board. There was a man who was a pain doctor who drugged his patients and raped them. And he preyed upon immigrants who weren't documented so that they wouldn't be able to say anything until there were finally so many women. And women complained to the board did nothing. And finally, when the police decided to charge him, the board said, oh, we'll ask you to voluntarily relinquish your license. There was a psychiatrist actually, who fondled women. And the board said, oh, he's the chair of this department. So we're just going to put a letter in his file that says he can only see men, not women. And I'm thinking, and who would want to take their son to this guy? I didn't even want to take my children to a doctor in Florida. And that's when I decided, you know what? I don't need Florida. I'm leaving. I'm going back to Texas. I'm done. I have my license, but I didn't want to get it this way. I wanted to get it because I earned it. Now, I'm going to turn to you, Warren, first, because I know that you've written about physician suicide, physician stress, and that's actually something you've worked in. And I see this medical board, I think, am I taking this personally, or does that sound like they were compounding the problem?
Oh, they were definitely compounding the problem. It's just so tragic and ironic that of all professions that physicians would handle a health problem in such a clunky fashion. I feel terrible about what you went through. That's going to make you feel depressed all over again, just dealing with them. The good news, if there is any, is that there has been a movement that the AMA and other professional groups have spearheaded to try to change the state's policies. And I think now approximately half of the 50 states no longer ask that crazy question, have you ever had an Axis One disorder, you know, depression or anxiety problem? There are efforts by the state professional organizations and the national to get those changes made in the other 25 states too. So perhaps in a few more years, the question will no longer exist. Unfortunately, here in Texas, they still ask that question.
Well, now in Texas, when I came, it said, have you ever been diagnosed with an Axis 1 disorder that has affected your practice?
Oh, okay.
And I could say, no, went every day, never got charged, did all my work, signed out my cases.
Okay.
But in Florida, it says, have you ever, and I would have to go back and look at Florida, but the Impaired Physicians Network, I would just sit down and cry when I got their mail. So, Michael, you have any comments?
Oh, there's such a richness of you know, stories in this, and I guess I'm reminded of two things. One, as I said at the beginning, every person is unique, but when Hank was talking about how hearing someone else read his story, there is universality too. So it's a paradox of each person's story is unique, and yet it touches everyone else's if you can be open to hear it.
This is very true, the universality, and I picked that up in Hank talking about hearing somebody else read his story, and hearing it from him meaning so much. So, Hank?
I'd like to hear if Michael has a story that might, you know, shed some light on the idea of how storytelling and depression are sort of inextricably related. Do you have a didn't mean to put you on the spot, but is there a short story that you can do to sort of capture what we are experiencing, what we are going through, what Mary is doing such a great job at navigating here?
I've got a little bit of a story. It's kind of I'll mask it so you don't really know who the person is who was going through this. And this is many years ago, but a person came to me. And they were really struggling, a young adult, and didn't believe in themselves at all. Was pre-law because their father had been pre-law and their grandfather had been pre-law and all their uncles were pre-law, but had no interest in law. And you know, I worked with this person for a long time, and once I even called in another psychologist to assess, because I was afraid I couldn't let this person go because I thought they were so suicidal. Really mad at me during that time, but did come back, and I think he got that I was really interested in his welfare, not in him liking me. Mm-hmm. And at one point in our work, he just said, like Britain. I was like, what are you talking about? He said, well, early in World War II, it would have been easy for Britain to give up. They were being bombed every day, civilians, nobody knew. But they said, no, we're going to persevere. So from then on, every time, you know, we got to a rough patch, I would just say, remember Britain? Hmm. And because it was the client's story, I think that made a difference. And then, you know, eventually stopped coming and see me, but, you know, did go on to law school, but was one of his choice, and you know, really was able to get through that desperate feeling of depression. So that's one story.
You know what I really like about that is it was his story,
yes,
like Britain. But when you said it, it was you were honoring his story. You were saying this is not me telling you what to do. This is me telling you what you've told yourself to do.
Right.
You know, so you own this.
Absolutely.
You own this. I'm just reminding you of it. And it's so important for each of us to own our story, you know, and own what makes us feel better also. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you'll constantly be dependent upon somebody from the outside to tell you something. But, I mean, yep. You tell him, but it's his story, and he appreciates it because he owns it.
Right.
So I have a favorite thing to do, and there's a lot of us. So, Warren, you want to say goodnight to anybody in Radioland?
Oh, okay. Well, I'll say goodnight. Well, I hadn't thought about that, but given the story that I told, I'll say goodnight to two people. Hadn't thought this through. Maybe I should have. The first one is Marcia, obviously, the one I'm living happily ever after with. But somewhere out there is the person I called Carol in my story. And she never realized it, but her words saved my life. So I'd like to say goodnight to her as well.
That's nice. Hank?
Peggy is right on my mind, and she always is. And I have never had great luck at meeting the right woman, and I really, I got the lottery when I met her.
Mm-hmm. Viktor Frankl, who is a mentor, has been dead for a long time, but his story was so powerful for so many people. A Man's Search for Meaning, that's the book, and I want to say goodnight to him and to Kelly, who drove me here tonight and could be doing other things, but is here with me tonight. So goodnight, Kelly.
You didn't tell people that Kelly drives an Uber. You didn't tell them that part.
No.
Okay. Yeah. Nicole, you're a special person here, and you're about to graduate. Who do you want to say goodnight to?
Well, I didn't think you were going to ask me. But I would like to say goodnight to everyone who cheered me on. And I also would like to say goodnight to all those naysayers, because your motivation pushed me beyond my own expectations. So good night to you, and I wish you all well.
Okay.
Nice.
And Greg?
Well, I would like to say good night and congratulations to my amazing niece, Morgan, who just graduated college at University of the Pacific. And after struggling with a lifetime of deafness and a cochlear implant, and I am so proud that she will be working with other kids with cochlear implants one day, I think.
Fabulous. So I'm going to treat myself, and I'm going to say goodnight to my two daughters, whom I heard Hank saying something about little expressions on about loving your kids. And what I always said to them is, if you look to the left, you can't see where my love starts. And if you look to the end, the other way, you can't see where it ends. So everybody stay put. Wild Bill and the Vinyl Avenger are up next with cool classics for the cooler you. Make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Wednesday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. Keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Mary Edgerton, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it's never too late to live happily ever after. And I hope this show brought that home to you. Peace.
Thousands of you have heeded the call, but there's always room for more. You can find KPFT on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. From our latest updates to funny videos, contests, news, and more, you can find us anytime, day or night. We're at KPFT Houston on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. We'd love to give you the latest. Plus, you're already on Facebook. Why not get behind the scenes of Houston's leader for independent music, arts, ideas, and culture right now? Again, find us at KPFT Houston on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. See you there. Get even more from your KPFT listening experience by checking out our HD2 stream. New and improved. Get acquainted with our revamped weekly schedule now at kpft.org. Fear not, nationally syndicated favorites like Democracy Now!, Ralph Nader Radio Hour, Letters in Politics, and Economic Update remain. And good news, our evening schedule now features more local shows, including a stellar mix of public affairs, music, comedy, and Spanish language programming created and produced right here at KPFT. Don't miss a second on HD2. Mouse on over to kpft.org or on TuneIn Radio today. KPFT, Houston.